This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A long and expensive legal battle between 500 female prisoners in the state of Michigan ended in an expensive way 6 years ago. The state agreed to pay $100 million to settle a class action suit by the hundreds of women who claimed they'd been sexually abused by prison guards. That legal fight started back in 1996. At the time of the settlement, the state took great care to note that the $100 million settlement was, and I'm quoting here, not an admission of guilt, but a compromise. Did that settlement produce changes in the way female inmates are treated in this state? Was there any backlash? Gina Fedock is an assistant professor with the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago. Her studies focus on the way women interact with the criminal legal system. Gina, welcome to Stateside.
Thank you for having me.
Give us a sense of context of history. How significant was that class action settlement in 2009?
Well, there's been no other class action lawsuit that has been of similar nature across the country. So Michigan is really unique in terms of this lawsuit. Now, in terms of the sexual abuse within the prison, that is not unique to Michigan. That is something that nationwide has been a concern. We know that back in 1993, President Bush was stating that sexual abuse in prisons is epidemic and that we should have a zero tolerance policy around sexual abuse in prison. So it's a problem that has persisted within prisons. But in terms of this lawsuit, it's something that put Michigan on the map nationwide because it was unprecedented.
What was the lawsuit about? Take us a little deeper into the details.
Well, the lawsuit started in 1996, and it was based on the fact that women were reporting that they were experiencing sexual abuse by officers within prison. And the sexual abuse ran from a continuum, from sexual harassment, which includes verbally degrading statements, terms being used against women, to privacy violations, which includes being watched while they were taking showers or were using the toilet, including being violated in terms of being groped, being touched inappropriately during pat-downs, as well as experiencing often repeated actual sexual assaults in terms of assaults that were more violating in nature. So women were experiencing these by officers, and it was brought up that about 30% of officers within the prison were involved in this sexual abuse.
So here we are 6 years out from that settlement, the state agreeing to pay $100 million to settle this class action suit. What changes do you think have come about because of the suit?
First of all, it's brought attention. What we know is that there's national policy, the Prison Rape Elimination Act, that has emphasized recommendations for prisons and jails and other correctional settings across the United States to try to bring about practices that allow for zero tolerance of sexual abuse within these settings. We know that attention was given to practices within Michigan in particular in terms of looking at getting male officers off of the women's housing units within the prison, because the lawsuit was specifically about male corrections officers. And so there was this push to put only female correction officers on the women's housing units.
Was that successful?
It has been successful, yes. But I think that it begs a deeper question, that sometimes we believe that only male correction officers can use degrading language, or that there can be an atmosphere of intimidation or abuse only with male corrections officers. And we have to look more at a system level change. Simply by changing out the officers, are we really creating deep, lasting change? And that's a deeper question that has to be asked.
It sounds like you're really saying it's a matter of the mindset.
Yes. I mean, what we know is that during the lawsuit, it came out that some officers knew that other officers were being abusive, but these officers didn't want to speak out against them because of this sort of culture of loyalty, this culture of silence and protection amongst officers. And I don't really see that within the policy that we're really addressing this sort of informal culture, what happens on a day-to-day basis, how are officers interacting with themselves? Have we changed the way that we view prisoners? Because part of the reason this abuse happened is because we view prisoners as second-class citizens. We call them by their last names or by numbers or by degrading terms. It's efforts to dehumanize them. If we're not using a human rights perspective, are we really making change within our prisons? You know, we had this idea that this was based on a few rogue officers, when in fact it's about a culture that allows abuse to happen. And are we really addressing this culture?
And we see even now here in Michigan, the ACLU is representing female inmates, 11 of them, in the Muskegon County Jail in a class action suit. Mm-hmm. And it sounds pretty familiar. Among other things, they're claiming male guards can watch the women while they change clothes and shower and use the lavatory. And they also note women are, in this lawsuit claim, that their women are denied access to clean underwear. and basic mm-hmm. sanitary items like toilet paper and feminine hygiene products. So I'm reading from that. And that case is pending. But let's look at this. Are women getting life's necessities as they should expect to be able to?
So right now, women at the State Women's Prison receive one pack of sanitary napkins a month, and they receive one roll of toilet paper per week. If they need more of these items, they have to pay for them, and they have to ask for them. Again, the deeper question is, what sort of dynamics does this set up? If you have to ask for and pay for basic necessities, this allows for a culture of abuse to occur. Some of the women say, you know, they ask for these items and they're being told, oh, we're out of that product, or I can't find that product. Now, an officer may be telling the truth and they may literally not be able to find that item, but they also may not be telling the truth. And so what does that do to a woman's psyche? What does that do in terms of their treatment? How do they make do without these basic necessities? And what does it mean that you also have to buy them, especially if you don't have outside support and you're making low wages within the prison?
That $100 million the state paid had to come from mm-hmm. somewhere. Did paying that money wind up impacting resources such as menstrual pads or toilet paper?
It's hard to know where that money is being pulled from. And I think that the assumption can be made that, yes, are women now being punished within prison for having been involved with this lawsuit? Is there now a backlash against women in prison because of this? Are they seeing less programs? Are they seeing less basic necessities because of this lawsuit? Who is being punished in terms of the lawsuit's effects?
I'm wondering what you found, Gina Fedak. Did the class action suit and that big settlement, how did that change the power dynamics between the guards and the prisoners, do you think?
Well, part of the problem is that it actually ended up being over 800 women who were involved in the lawsuit. And so not all of these 800 women actually left prison. And some of them left prison and then came back to prison. So you have those who are serving life sentences, long-term sentences, as well as those who are back in prison. And it wasn't necessarily a secret in terms of who was participating. The media was involved. It's what we call a closed system. So it's an institution where people live and work, which has its own rules, policies, procedures, and people pretty much know each other. So there's a history amongst officers who've been there a long time. They know the women know each other. So it's not necessarily a secret in terms of who's been involved and who hasn't, who may be receiving those payments and who may not be. There's a risk there in terms of, are women being mistreated because they're receiving that money? What has that done? In some ways, I think, again, you're not going to see one type of response by all officers. I think there were some, you know, who really respect that the women valued safety, and then there are some who may feel more bitter. I mean, there's going to be a range of responses in terms of that.
You actually were telling us that you've had women tell you that they describe when they have attempted suicide, officers have said, go ahead, no one cares if you die.
And this is something that's particular for women serving long-term or life sentences. Again, I want to press that not all corrections officers say
sure.
things that are degrading. There's a range of experiences.
Sure.
And one of the things is that women spend a lot of time trying to figure out who's safe and who's not safe. In terms of women who have life or long-term sentences, we know that these increasingly actually mean life until the end of natural life, until you reach advanced terminal illness. And so there's this idea of being throwaways within the prison, and that's actually coming out in terms of their interactions with some officers and the way they're being treated in outside society as well as within the prison. So what we know is that nationwide, only about 40%, or to say it more clearly, about 60% of those serving life sentences are not receiving any programming while they're in prison. Because programming is reserved for those who are being rehabilitated, those are who are preparing to leave prison. And if you have a life sentence, you're not being rehabilitated. There aren't resources going in to rehabilitation for you. The idea is that you're in prison for life, you're not getting out, so you don't receive those resources. And we have to think about what that means on the psychological level for women serving life sentences. You become, again, through the practices and policies, are you being treated as someone who's worth any of these resources? And it's really difficult because if you imagine coming in, we know the average age of entering with a life sentence is about 24, 25 in Michigan, and you're spending the rest of your life course in prison not really receiving programming to know what you need to change about yourself, how you can make self-improvement. Sometimes when the women have been involved in self-harm or suicide attempts, there is this sort of nonchalant attitude by some officers in terms of their risk or their experiences, because they're lifers. They're at the bottom of the barrel in terms of importance within the prison.
How do you even create a policy that regulates statements like that?
That's one of the big issues. I mean, you can see on MDOC's website, they list the number of allegations of sexual abuse, from sexual harassment to actual sexual assault. And what I saw is that there have been 245 allegations of sexual harassment. So that's verbally degrading statements. Of those allegations by prisoners of staff sexual harassment, zero were found to be substantiated. So that means that the prison had to do an investigation to see if those allegations were true, and it found that none of those were true. This is problematic because what we know is that the investigation itself can be limited in terms of actually validating women's experiences of abuse. So, for example, a lot of times you have to have some form of physical evidence to show that you've actually been abused. Now, how do you have physical evidence of being sexually harassed? Mm-hmm. How do you, unless there was a physical injury that was noticeable or caught by medical staff, it's hard to prove that some of these instances have happened. And we know that what also goes against women is that they are prisoners. And so we have this idea that they're deviant, that they're manipulative, that they're, again, second-class citizens mm-hmm. who we can't trust. So I find that problematic, that there have been over 200 allegations of sexual harassment, but none were found to be substantiated. To me, it's what's happening there in the reporting and in the investigation process as well.
Gina, what do you think, based on your years of studying the interaction of these women with the prison, with the corrections system, what needs to happen, do you think, to improve the way women are treated in Michigan's prisons and jails?
Absolutely. I think we need to think about policy recommendations are a great way to start, but how do we make sure that policy translate into real change that comes from a human rights perspective? How do we have humane treatment in the day-to-day of our prisons and jails and other correctional settings? And one way is we can look at internationally, looking at, for example, Norway was just written up in the New York Times about trying to embed humaneness into their prison design. So the way that they created their prison, the way the officers are acting, the way that they're treating inmates, and the way that inmates are expected to be acting. This idea of humaneness throughout the continuum of interaction with the criminal justice system. We know the criminal justice system is broken at every stage. So how do we start to infuse it with a human rights perspective from the moment of that first interaction through every single one? And I think we can find some insights through international perspectives, as well as really thinking in new ways about what prisons mean and what are ethical and moral ways of having punishment settings. You know, I'm coming from a perspective of social work, and mm-hmm. so I look at our values and our code of ethics in terms of how do we promote a punitive system that actually treats people with respect and dignity. And that can actually change multiple levels of our society.
There's this, almost I think of a teeter-totter in a way, because there is that concern about, you know, the idea of human rights and humane treatment. And then we know that there are people listening to this conversation saying, well, it's prison. It's not a summer, you know, it's
right.
not a summer camp.
Right.
They committed a crime. Why should they have special treatment? And why should we be concerned? How do you respond to that?
First of all, I think there's no simple answer. But the second thing is that in other countries, for example, in Canada and in Norway, the idea is that whenever you're placed in prison or jail, you're being separated from your family and friends in the outside world. That is the punishment. The punishment isn't about degrading someone on an everyday basis and all your interactions with them. The idea is that you're being separated. Now you have to go through rehabilitation training. The separation is your punishment. And I think that we have to think about, what do we want our boundaries of punishment to be? Do we believe that people should be abused in prison? Do we believe that they should be put in segregation for months on end? Do we believe that they should simply be medicated on a daily basis? Do we believe that they should not be given proper water or proper conditions? I mean, we know that one of the issues in the Michigan Women's Prison and across the country is issues of overcrowding. So women being put in storage closets instead of proper cells. I mean, if we can think about, what does punishment mean? Does it mean that you're being separated from the rest of society? And if that's what the punishment is, then how can we create prisons that actually seek to improve people's lives for the sake of our whole society versus prisons where it is, let's make people worse off than they were when they first came in? And also thinking about, are prisons for people with nonviolent offenses? Are they for people with violent offenses? What is our purpose? You know, there are a lot of great creative suggestions around doing more community-level action, especially around nonviolent offenses, and thinking about prisons are costly to our states and to our country in terms of how much we're spending to incarcerate people. Whenever we put them in inhumane conditions, it's creating larger burdens on the medical and the physical mental health facilities within those prisons. We're seeing a rise in suicides. We're seeing a rise in mental health care costs and physical health care costs. We're having more people aging in prison. And that's going to be more taxing for people in the community as well. So this isn't something that if you say, let's just throw away people in prison and who cares how they do, it's actually impacting all of us on a daily basis.
Gina Fedduck is an assistant professor at the School of Social Service Administration at the University of Chicago, and her studies focus on the way women interact with the criminal legal system. Gina, thank you so much for talking with us on Stateside today.
Thank you so much for having me, and thank you for covering this topic.